off, and up stood Guru Nanak and looked at them and disappeared in a cloud of light. But he left them two bunches of roses. This is the Lord of the Soul doing it. The Hindus took their roses and cremated, and the Muslims took their roses and buried it. And Guru Nanak's coffin is still here and Guru Nanak is gone. But the Hindus and the Muslims haven't changed their attitude to each other. Now, those who remain to think of Guru Nanak will say, well, surely, yeah, he was a man from the Lord of the Soul, but where is he now? You see? The Lord of the Soul sends these beings into us periodically to help us to realize that there is another realm we have to go to.
Vedana, you said that in the realm of the soul there is not a purpose to the mind. Is that the purpose of repetition in meditation?
Yes. The purpose of repetition in meditation is to free us from the mind when we enter the realm of the soul. That's why they say you begin by ridding yourself of your mind through repetition. It's not a mindless action. It's a mindful action. Repetition is a mindful action of reminding yourself that there is no mind to carry with you when you repeat something. Do you follow what I'm saying? So you don't enter a state of mindlessness. You enter a state of mindfulness. Not a polluted mind or a clouded up mind. Now you're mindful of where you are, but you're not using the mind to see. It's suddenly synchronized to flow. So repetition is the key to enter soul nature.
Can you do that and work out, let's say, a mathematical problem all at the same time? How can you think of two things at once? That's what I'm saying. How can you be repeating something mentally? Your mind is trying to work out 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Yeah, you know, it was difficult for me to do years ago to work and still do Simran or repeat the holy name or hallow the name of the Lord, which is Japa or anything. That's making repetition, the word repetition, or something going on in the mind. It was very difficult because I couldn't break the association of concentration on what I was actually doing plus what I was trying to mentally relate. But after a while, by merely doing it and working, suddenly one day I found myself working completely efficient on a conscious level, and then the next part of my brain is going on automatic inside. Well, in those days I would say to myself, I'm in a level of my consciousness and it's altered. And I know it, I can prove it, I can always go into it. But deep down in the nature, since we are associated with the material world, we would like to have some type of instrumentation to verify it. The ancient yogis in the mountain caves didn't need it because they were fully convinced that something had happened already, and so why need an instrument to verify it? Simply because they did not live in an environment in where it says, prove it to me. We live in an environment where any change in your mechanism, somebody will shout that particular phrase, prove it to me. So it triggers a reaction in you. I am for both experiences, where you experience it and don't need to be proven by machinery. And I'm also interested in the investigative mind that can take a piece of machinery and go ahead and prove it. So both are good, but there is a handicap in one, that's all. And we have to go back to Jesus, and Jesus is the man who gives us the information. Blessed are they who believe and have not seen, than they who have seen and believe. The man in the mountain caves, he's really not mixed up. When he gets the experience and knows there is a change, he doesn't have to fall back and have mental guilt actions. That's what you call belief without seeing. He knows now that something has happened, and he accepts it and he goes on. We over here who have had the experience and then we have something to back it up by measuring it, we indicate a sort of weakness, but it's a sort of a strength at the same time. It's a weakness in our own abilities to trust ourselves, but it's a strength in the ability to investigate for ourselves. You see, we have a compensation. Not every bad is totally bad, but it has some good in it. There is a good in trying to know why you did it, just as much as it's a hindrance because you want to check it out every time if you're doing it. That could be the hindrance. You do something, and every time you do it, you're not too certain, you want to go check it out all the time. You don't trust it. So you develop a doubting nature after a while. So it is good to have both, but not to be overburdened by the instrumentation. Instrumentation should only be a last-minute resort to rid the mind that these things are actually going on. Once you've got it going, then you know it's inside, it's working. For my own self, years ago, this was there. See? And in today's research, which I was very happy to see happen, it makes for these techniques that are handed down all through the centuries that they are genuine. We haven't learned any new technique. We have only learned new semantics for them. But they work. I remember I was at an acupuncture seminar, and the doctor got up and wrote on the blackboard, he says, 5,000 years ago, these peculiar Chinese people discovered, and he wrote a number on the board, acupuncture points. And he said, after 3.5 years of grants and researches, to the tune of $320,000, we have also discovered a total of acupuncture points, and he wrote the same number underneath it. So everybody looked at him, so what's the difference? Is it the same? He says, yeah, we didn't learn anything new. So the question comes up in the seminar, we were founded by electronic measurements. How did they discover it when they had no electricity in those days? What method did they do to find these points in the body? Now, there are 800 points in the body. We have done it in the last 3.5 years by research with electrical equipment, and it's a total 800. Well, we know we got the data for it. But how did they find the 800? And if you were to look the whole body to find 800 points without any equipment, it's pretty recurrent. You're raising. So a whole lot of theories came out or possible ways that man could find these 800 points without electrical equipment. And you know, the only possibility that seemed feasible for everybody, yet they would not accept it, is that man might have discovered these 800 points by the pendulum. But it's not feasible enough to the scientific mind to want to accept that the 800 points could have been discovered that way. They will want to say that they probe the body so much every day, like a bunch of torturers trying to find these points.
There were people that were gifted enough to argue, yes, maybe they still are, to see each point, the light, well, the color of it.
There are lots of clairvoyants who can see the points, but if you pin down the clairvoyants, they're not going to count them. They'll have to be spending lots of long hours to really count these points and locate them. But they can see the points where they are. But you see, seeing the points by clairvoyance is not seeing it in a totalistic state. You're only seeing them when there's an illness in the body. The clairvoyant can only pick up when there's a deficiency or a hyper state or an excess state in those points. He's going to see it. Now, the x-ray doesn't show you where the points are either. So only when there are excess conditions or deficiency conditions does the clairvoyant fix it up.
Why did they really do it? By the pendulum?
They haven't said it was done by the pendulum. They came up with the possible conditions.
No, but I'm asking you how they did it.
Well, I'm more in agreement that they found it by the pendulum. Put it that way.
And the tail part. You get it out, you start using it all over again.
Watch, he's been at the medical college right now.
Trying to find a cancer cure.
He won that award for his mice.
Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Would you give an example of psychic illness? I understand the physical and the mental, but psychic illness. And you said these were all healed by surrender. But would you give me an example?
Yes. One of the psychic illnesses that we suffer from is a sense of over-perfectionism. That's a form of psychic illness. A sense of over-perfectionism. It's a form of psychic illness. Whenever you find the individual is hell-bent or heaven-bent for perfection, you're looking at a sick person.
Is that self-righteousness?
That's a form of mental illness, not psychic illness. Self-righteousness is a mental illness. Psychic illness is that he's doing every single thing to the extent of damaging the body to be extra perfect. Well, let me explain. Satan is not a separate entity. It is the aspect of God that is flowing out from the realm of non-manifestation. God, if you take the word God, in its true aspect, it represents total goodness. Now, what is total goodness? There is no physical object, actually speaking, that is totally good. We couldn't relate to it from a mental level to compare it. We can only sense goodness. That would be a feeling from the soul's level. So we say God is good. God is the all good. And Jesus says, call no man good save the Father. So the term God infers goodness, which is a quality, which is perfection. It's not decomposing, it's not rotting or anything wrong with it. It's good. Now, the opposite of goodness would be a manifestation that is going to be subject to breakdown. So it has to be in opposition. It has to have the qualities of breaking down, have the qualities of deterioration. So the word Satan is Hebrew for opposition, adversary. It's not a person. We tend to personalize it. Most Oriental thinkers do that. They tend to personalize impersonal concepts simply because the mind wants something physical to relate. If goodness is going to project the opposite of goodness, it must have a form from which we can look and observe and say that this thing is not good. So we immediately use thing, the word thing, object, in the frame of reference to indicate the opposite of goodness. We have to have some actual thing to examine for a frame of reference for goodness and to say that it's not good. And how it holds itself up, how it falls apart, this will tell us the degrees of bad or not good. So it's in opposition to the thinking process of good. This is what is happening to us. Now, ego has nothing to do with it. If you look at the word itself, it merely says energy going out. Big I. We always refer to me, mine, as ego. These are only terms of the energy itself, from the good state to the non-good state. But where is it going from? Energy moves. Energy is neither good nor bad. But because it must move, the point of reference is in the mind. The mind has to have something to relate. So the mind wants to say, it goes from good to bad, and from bad to good. And in the process of going back and forth, we can overemphasize or underemphasize, and that would be egotistical. Now, if we drop off these personality conditions and look at the thing objectively and see, is energy moving backwards and forwards in its own makeup? Now, we have a strange phenomenon in the human body. Right in the human body, we have 14 meridians. They don't change. They're already established in the human body as the electric circuitry of the body. It's called your electrical body. There are 14 lines that run. Now, along these 14 meridians or pathways, we have a series of entrances and exits. But these pathways don't just end here or start here, or begin here and end here, or begin here. They lock into each other. So it will seem that they tie in to each other. So really, it's one long string, if you want to pull the whole thing out, that is making 14 loops through the whole mechanism. So if you pull out all the loops, you have one circle. Now, to tell an individual that you really don't have 14 pathways in your mechanism, you only have one pathway with 14 loops in it, doesn't make any sense to the individual who is observing this phenomenon. It's equally true to say that you don't have an ego, but it's a flow of energy that's coming and going from its source within you, and you are personalizing its movement. You're emphasizing its movement. This is exactly the same thing that's happening in the energy in these pathways. The energy is positive and negative, but it's looping itself around this physical frame in 14 loops. Now, at each turn of the loop, where the loop makes a turn, one edge of the loop is positive, one edge of the loop is negative, and there's no sudden break and there's no sudden start. It's just a loop. Like your hands. Your left hand is negative, yet your left hand is positive. How can that be? Isn't that a contradiction? Your right hand is positive, yet your right hand is negative. That's a contradiction. But we'll show you. How many sides your hand have? All right. Is this side different than this side? How? Inside here, only a certain area of this palm, we have 2,700 pores per square inch. And on the back here, we don't have 2,700 pores per square inch. But it's the same tissue here and the same tissue here. Here we have 2,700 pores per square inch. We don't have 2,700 pores per square inch here. Yet this section of the skin is equal to the same section of skin under the mic. They are the same. They look the same. 700. This one's got 2,700. Now, if you take the skin off from this, the palm of the hand, you take the skin off from the top of the hand and you put it under the microscope, I never told the person who is examining it from which part of the body it came from. He would never know unless he count the pores per square inch. And there are only four parts of the body that the pores per square inch are 2,700. The sole of the feet and the palm of the hand. And every other area is exactly per square inch. So how are you going to know? The pores here, the per square inch is the same. The size and shape are the same as the pores over here. Now, why is this positive and why is it negative? I said the left hand is negative and it's positive at the same time. The downward movement of the blood is moving this way. See? So it's going away from us. And the upward movement of the blood is coming up this way, in this part. Now, so we say we have a negative flow and we have a positive flow. All right. In the palm of the left hand, it's negative. The energy is flowing this way. On the surface of the hand, the energy is flowing this way. It's positive. It's flowing negative this way. Notice what I'm saying? It's going negative this way. Comes to the fingertip, it's going back this way, it's positive. Now, in this hand, the energy is flowing this way, it's positive. To come up to the other side, and it's coming negative this way. So inside it's positive, outside here is negative. Outside here is positive, outside here is negative.
Do you ever, use the backs of the hand to pull in?
Yes. With your new research now with galvanic measurements, they are actually checking them, and you can see it. That on the outside of the left hand, it's positive, on the inside it's negative. On the inside of the right hand it's positive, on the outside it's negative.
Yeah, but in using it, what is the advantage or disadvantage?
The advantage is that if you're going to hook up a battery to another battery to give it a boost, would you hook negative to positive? Oh. What would you do?
Negative to negative.
Negative to negative. If you did hook up positive to negative, what would you have? Is that from common sense or is that from experience? Equally true. Stroking the body, it's supposed to show you, we can kill ourselves by our own remedies, you know, healing remedies. We can even hurt ourselves with it, when we don't understand. You can rub a part of the body that is ill with one particular stroking method and help it. And do it in reverse, the stroking method would create an adverse condition. That's why the body is becoming more and more recognized as electrical equipment. They're understanding it. But not every type of massage works. Just not every type of pressure would work. They vary because these are electrical conditions in the body. Now, let's say this part of my foot was swollen and you wanted to massage it to take it down, to help it. You'll come with both hands and work it, right? Because that would be the natural attitude. But if I told you that this here is negative and that this here is positive and that you could effect a greater change by just taking the right hand, which is positive inside and negative outside, and touch this part, you would have a quicker release. And if you took both hands and rubbed it. So, I said outside is negative, inside is positive. Inside is positive, outside is negative.
In other words, it goes with the blood.
So if you put the two, what do we got here?
Put negative against positive.
Yeah, then it would be wrong, right? Good, it would be wrong. So what hand would you put here then? Good. I'll show you why it will be the other hand there, friend. You sit down in front of me. Now, face me. Which hand would you stretch out to touch? Put out both hands. Put them out, put the palms down. Put it out straight and put the palms down. All right, let it come down on the feet. Now, what have you got? Is it correct or wrong? Good. I didn't make it, you know. Just show you how this thing is accurate. It's not a hit and miss. It's exactly as it is. There is no way that it's going to end up on the wrong contact. This is exactly as it will be. So Jesus took this spittle on the ground and rubbed it to the dirt and put it in the blind man's eye. It's kind of funny type of therapy. But there is a method to all these things. There are very deep scientific rules behind them if you try to understand them. And it has to do with the spiritual nature of man. There's so much to understand.
I'm still confused about the
The way the blood is flowing.
But Don, that's what your reaction to you when you have both hands on there.
I hit a meridian and
no, I mean if you have both negative thoughts on the negative side or positive side. What's your response to you in the body?
Well, look again. If the sole of the foot...
Yeah, but look, she's got both
feet. Wait a minute. Observe. If the sole of the foot is what? The right foot now. You're doing the right foot, what I just said. All right, positive, right?
Yeah.
And the top of the foot is negative.
Mm-hmm.
And you're putting what hand? By lining it up.
Two.
Oh, first line up. Put the hand. All right. What is making contact with? All right, hold the foot. Grab a hold of the foot.
Oh, okay.
All right, the natural way to grabble the foot would be that way, right? Try and grabble the foot that way with the other hand and see the awkwardness of it. It's not practical, right? Put the hand, now grabble the foot. How would you grabble the foot with the other hand?
Naturally, the way
yeah.
I do it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Right,
this is the natural way to hold the foot. So what are you making there? Don't you see you've made an electrical bond already? So when you're massaging, you're automatically doing the thing, unconsciously. But when it's pointed out to you scientifically and specifically, you're getting greater results. That's the difference between knowledge and just doing it helter-skelter. Now, which hand, you're working on my right foot, which hand gives more pressure to the foot? From above or from below? Look at both hands, work them and see. This is how you discover where your sense of direction and motivation are involved in the hand.
But my right's below.
All right.
Mostly my thumb.
Good. And that's where it should be in the first place, working from below. So the top is only a contact point for the working underneath, and the left hand is more pressure above and less below. So you have the same magnetic principle working. So how many fingers are doing work above, and how many doing underneath?
It's two underneath,
yeah.
And eight above.
Right.
You don't want to start.
Because if you're working on yourself, then you have difficulty.
No, because in yourself, you it becomes obvious.
No, I think it works this way.
Okay. It becomes more.
Yeah.
You start off with left foot first. This is your left foot first.
She's talking about holding it this way.
Oh, no, that's not that has to do what we're talking about. We're talking about an electrical condition.
You're talking about where the blood's going. You start with the left and go up to the left.
John, did you start talking about ego?
Yeah, we just covered it. I hope you don't think the ego is something that you can cut out of your body and look at it. It's a frame of reference for the flow of the energy within your nature that you put certain semantics around and certain qualities and identify it. You see? It's like, take for instance, today is what day? You sure? All right. What part of it is day, what part of it is night?
The mind is dead.
Where are you?
What happened? No, that's a Donna doing it.
A day is a composite of night and day, right? Isn't that what a day is? A day is a composite of night and day. Listen to how we trick ourselves and we use it all the time and we are still victim to the terminology. A day is a composite of... It's not a composite of night and day. A day is a composite of the darkness and light. So many hours of darkness, so many hours of light. We call a day. So we classify darkness and light as a day. Now, really, is there such a thing as a day? There is no such thing as a day because the condition of darkness and light is dependent upon motion of the object we're living on. So that blows the illusion now that we don't have no days.
We can now send you next week.
You see? But because of the frame of reference and the point of motion to where you came from, to where you have to go, you have to start reckoning. So you count the darkness and the light as so many repetitions, and you classify it as a day. So the question comes up, which came first?
Watch that, Danny. Don't let it get over there on it.
All right, the question comes up, which came first, the darkness or the light? Huh? Which came first? The darkness or the light? Huh? Okay, you see, our scriptures aren't wrong. It's very scientific and very factual as what has happened in the universe out there when it came into manifestation. In the cold refrigerator of space and time, there was no light. It was just a cold refrigerator. Out there is just one big giant refrigerator. It's so cold. It's fantastic. One big giant refrigerator out there. And there is nothing inside but lovely little objects floating around. And they have beautiful names when they start to brighten up. And you go in a refrigerator and you don't have no light. Can you detect an onion from a potato?
By feeling it.
By feeling it and by smelling it. Yeah. All right. Okay. Equally true, in this giant refrigerator of a universe, objects are moving around in it that have no way of being recognized. So the creative intelligence merely did what? Turn on the switch and you'll know which is the potato, you'll know which is the onions.
Okay.
So it's the same thing. The switch was turned off and the sun became that focal light. And then we begin to identify other objects by giving them names. So really, there is no such thing as a day. It's a condition that measures the period of darkness to the period of light. Do you see how our illusions of our existence are suddenly falling apart?
I'm in Satchkan, my feet popped up.
Well, naturally you're in Satchkan. You see, one time a student says he had a dream of Yogananda. And he said to Yogananda, he says, when will I get to Satchkan? Will you take me to Satchkan? And Yogananda says, where is that? That was the end of the dream. Then he told me the dream. He says, well, why did Yogananda tell him that? He says, but I think I understand why Yogananda told me that before I ever began to explain it. He says, I can realize now. There is no place called Satchkan. It's only me. And I am busy looking for me.
I tell you, I was there when my feet popped up.
See, Satchkan, the word Satchkan means abode or eternal abode or the eternal here. H-E-R-E. Now, the eternal here is not a place. It's a condition of consciousness involving a time principle.
I thought time wasn't up there.
involving a time principle. There's no such thing as time. It's a condition. Now, the term here, H-E-R-E, is not a place. It's a condition involving a time principle. Now, hairness, H-E-R-E-N-E-S-S, is the phenomena that creates all the problems with us.
I thought we were supposed to be here now.
That was what the book said, be here now? Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. He wrote be here now. He was really saying, learn to be in the hairness of now. You didn't understand what he was writing. You can't be here now because you're here already. You have to be in the hairness of now. You have to enter a state of hairness. Since you're already here, it's a condition of time. See? So Baba Ram Das was writing his book, but he was writing in such a way that the average individual did not comprehend what he wrote. The yogis are all telling us the same thing. The scientists are telling us the same thing. That this is a condition. But we have to take points of references for comparison. And once we do that, then we are going to be involved with personality and impersonalness. Now, this is not bad, neither is it good. These are the conditions that you must accept to work with it. These are the rules of the game. Now, the penalties of the game and the rewards of the game are all good. It is how you play the game that's important.
You don't cheat.
You know, I'm going to put a, now that you made a statement like that, here's an interesting phenomenon in your Bible. Uh-oh. Who is the greatest cheater?
I'm scared to answer.
No, the greatest cheater is the person who created the universe out of himself.
I thought you said teacher.
Cheat. He said, don't cheat.
I said, but
here's an interesting phenomenon. We use the word cheat. And yet they say the question is, who is the greatest cheater? The creative force that created the universe out of himself is the greatest cheater. If you understand the principle of the word cheat.
I think you're thinking of one thing and I'm thinking of another.
Mm-hmm.
What's your version?
Is to use something without paying for it.
Yeah.
Right?
I would say you pay for it, though. Well,
it's a something for nothing attitude. Cheating,
yeah.
Cheating is a something for nothing attitude.
Yeah.
Because you're cheating and you're not involving yourself in the responsibility of being.
But you said the creator.
Yeah.
But he made it us out of himself, so therefore he would pay himself.
You're saying he can pay himself.
Well, we've got to go home eventually. I don't know what he'll get.
To show you what is involved in the word cheat, you see, in your mind, cheat immediately becomes negative. It's a funny phenomenon how we think in this world. Everything has got to be negative, it is not good. You don't understand when we use the word negative. We are not talking of badness or we are talking of levels of movement inside of ourselves. Now, when we said the greatest cheater and the greatest dictator is God himself, because he made everything out of himself. And on top of the bargain, he withdrew from the whole thing and leave us hanging stranded.
I'm great.
You see, that's how he cheated us. Right? 7 days he made, 6 days he made everything, and the 7th day he took off. And he made it out of nothing,
and left
us with something, and there's only one portion, maybe 1 billionth portion of what he didn't use. You see, because he didn't say he used up everything, and he didn't say where he took it from. He took it out from within himself, and then he withdraw from the whole thing, leaving it to us to believe that that's all of him. So who got the short end of the deal? So when you try to understand this word, you see a lot of things involved in it. Our whole universe is fantastic if we begin to see it. One teacher said, saintliness is glorified madness.
almost as good as that little thing that says, to become a saint, all you have to do is walk when you want to sit. Sit when you want to walk. Be quiet when you want to talk. It's really easy. Anybody can do it.
Yeah. Well, that's what's called glorified madness. Don't do what you want to do, then you'll be able to do what you like to do.
How do you get the like in there?
Don't do what you want to do, then you will be able to do what you like to do.
You gain the strength from the other.
Yeah. If you say you don't want to go to the bathroom, sooner or later you'll like to go to the bathroom. Huh? Yes. You're coming back to your ego, you know.
That's my problem. I keep coming.
In the Eastern teachings, in the science of the soul, it says there are only five functions that the negative flow that locks us into matter. These five conditions that locks us into matter are, they call them the five deadly sins in this scriptural semantics. In the psychological semantics, we use the word greed, lust, anger, hate, ego. These are the five deadly sins. Now, Guru Nanak, when he was in the body, he said, I have been able to calm the ocean with my mind. I have scaled the mountain peaks with my spirit. I have been all over the universe, but I did not find anyone who could teach me to control these five forces. That's greed, anger, hate, lust, ego. Yet, these same five forces are resolved in our nature. Simple by the fact that we can listen. So, if we listen to ourselves, we can resolve these five forces. So, of all the statements of discipline that Jesus gave, the one statement, meekly wait and grumble not, or mumble not, or murmur not, the word is actually meekly wait and murmur not. This will take care of the greed, it will take care of the lust, the anger, the hatred, and the ego. To meekly wait and murmur not. Now, someone says, well, where did the Buddhists come in? Where do they fit into this picture? Have they something to add to this? Buddha said the same concept hundreds of years ago before Jesus. And he said, murmur not. You see, he used the same word, murmur, or don't grumble. Murmur not at the dispensation of God. How God dispenses this universe. Don't grumble at the way things are happening. For his wisdom is unbounded, and his power is unlimited. That will take care of your ego, it will take care of the lust, the greed, the anger, the hate. The very five forces are taken care of by don't gripe. Number one level, which is the fifth level, or master level, or Christ level, is called now consciousness acting on energy. That consciousness, that Christ intelligence, not Master Jesus now, that Christ intelligence that permeates that level of creation controls all the actions of creation. In that level, you have an advocate, you have a bridge, you have someone who pleads your case. Now you know something has to do the action for you. A higher consciousness has to act for you. That is the first step back. Like the father meeting the son at the halfway mark and recognizing him and willingly embracing him. But you see, though he embraced him and accepted him, he still made him clean up to go home and take a bath, and then he put on a robe and a ring and all these things. It's the next two levels where he's going to get all this wonderful bequeath, the will of God. You see, we leave our bequeath or our will to our heirs, so they become the beneficiary. On the next two levels up, we now partake of these forces in the Lord of the Soul's realm. So the next level up is called consciousness acting on consciousness. For the first time, you are truly free from all the repercussions of death that the soul's body is subject to while in creation, provided by the Lord of creation. There is no such thing now affecting the soul. There is no such illusion anymore for the soul that the body has to die. That is what Jesus is saying. Be not afraid of him who will destroy the body. Don't be afraid of the Lord of creation that provides a chemical body for the soul's activity and fear and ponder and go into trauma simply because you lose this body as an identification point. But be afraid of him, that's the Lord of the soul, who can destroy both body and soul. That's where the consciousness is involved now. So we go out, we leave the thousand-petal lotus, and we ascend inside now to the next level, which is called beingness acting on consciousness. This is where Jesus ascended and sat in the right hand of the Father. That level of the soul we go on to. We have to go to that state. We have to surrender. The last four levels up in spiritual life is a life of surrender. It's a life of gradual letting go of the creative forms around us. Now, we're not going to lose anything. We're not supposed to know that. Or if we know that too soon, we will all let go right away, and then creation would not be here. And then a lot of creation is going to blame that guy who told the secret to everybody. And then he's got karma. We're not supposed to know ahead of time that if we all let go of the creation, we will be rewarded back with the super creation. That means the ring and the robe and the scepter and everything. See, the boy did not know by turning around merely to go back home, his father was going to give him everything. The soul does not know that when it leaves the lower realm and heads to the higher realm, this is bequeathed already for him. But you remember the prodigal son story. There was another brother. And the other brother came home and saw the feasting. And he complained. He says, while I was here, you never killed a fatted calf. You never did all these things. And now our brother who's gone out and squandered everything comes back and you loll upon him and do everything. And you know what the father said to the second brother? But he said, you never invite your friends. You see, you never invite. You had it all, but you never made anything of it. It was like you were hatching on it. You were sitting back on your laurels. Whereas your brother, though he appeared in our mind and in your mind to have gone out and squandered and has returned from the far land, he, went through the test. This is the difference between those souls who don't want to come out into the world of creation lest they get polluted by it. They are so saintly that their saintliness smells. We have a few of them. We are fortunate to have the body to make the mistake and not even to know that our Father wouldn't abandon us in this creation. We are so fortunate that even when we do recognize and we're told the secret of it all, that He has left us the bequeath of His love and glory. That our saintliness is the result of accepting God's game that He's playing to entertain His children. That Uncle Satan is not a bad guy. He's already designed there to make it as hard as it can be with all the problems of exorcism and repossessions. And if you don't pay your exorcist, you're going to be repossessed. So these are all the parts that the Lord of Creation has designed as a marvelous comedy tragedy, very serious, very traumatic, to keep us entertained and even to scare us like the boogeyman that Daddy has left us here to be destroyed or devoured by him. These are all the subtle maneuvers to make it work. When we realize that none of these things really are to hold us here, then our true work has begun. We are then living in that realm of the soul. So, in the event that Yama, the Lord of Death, should pay you a visit anytime and ask you the eternal question of which one of the karmas you want, I hope you make the right choice. Don't ask for your bad karma first. Don't ask for your bad karma first. Ask for your good one first. The good karma is the key. See, most of us will ask for the bad one because we weigh in our mind, not in our soul. But if I can handle all the bad ones now, I can look forward to the good ones after. But you see, you don't know what the good karma will entail if you ask for it first. You're still worrying about if you take the good one first, now you've got the bad one to handle after. But the way it's set up on the inner realm for the soul to get back by grace is to ask for the good karma first. It does not matter how sinful you might think you are in this world, how many things you have done that made you hate and feel guilty in this world that you live in. These are all part of the game, all part of the internal show. It's the association of grace. In the outer world, it seems kind of comedy and so tragic that on the inner realm, it is all organized, set up for our good, not for our damnation or destruction. The hell and the heaven is inside of us. They are not actual physical realms, but they are conditions in which we find ourselves. And if we don't know the rules of the game, then we can make a realm a real hell and never get out of it. We can find ourselves in one of these realms and really be pinned down in it by guilt. Yet none of these realms have any way to hold us by any condition. They are merely set up there for us to pass through. on the earth as we live, there are always masters representing the Lord of creation. And they are masters who represent the Lord of the soul. As Jesus said, seek the truth which is within you and its righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. And the truth will make you free. It's free from the creation, free from the involvement with the creation and the Lord of creation, the accounting of karma. Free men all, Lord of yourself. For the first time, you are living in the realm of the soul. In the realm of the soul, we don't use the mind. In the realm of the creation, we use the mind. And everything in creation requires the mind as a builder to reinforce it, to hold it, to be attached to it. When we leave the realm of creation and enter the realm of the soul, we have to, what you say, jettison the mind. You know that term, jettison the mind? In an airplane, if you got too much weight and they want to get rid of it, they jettison it or drop it. It's the same thing inside. You suddenly have to jettison the mind when we want to go up. In creation, we use the mind by initiative. By every self-act, the mind is building it to make it work. In the Lord of the Soul's realm, we don't have no use for the mind. We have to jettison that, and we have to go now by humility, which means to pull us. We are like a fish that has bit the bait but can't get into the frying pan until the fisherman reels us in. And we can run all over with the bait in our mouth. But if somebody has to reel us in, and in the last four realms of the soul itself, we are reeled in. We don't just jump out and go into that particular level. We are actually pulled in. So when we come deep into our inner nature and we begin to surrender more, then the mind would not interfere. That doesn't say that the mind is not used for your daily activities and your daily responsibilities. But in the inner realm of your meditative life, you don't use mind. You don't use the complications of the mind or the computing of the mind or the reasoning of the mind. You use feeling, which is soul nature now, by letting go. We are drawn up to the Lord of the soul inwardly by music, by sound. We find our way back through the sound currents. So as we listen inside, the soul is pulled back, right back to its source. That is why when you begin to meditate, you're not too concerned with what you see. You're more concerned with what you hear. Because at best, it is written in all the scriptures, no man saw God, but heard his voice. And seeing the radiant form is a form of the spiritual teacher who allows you to perceive what this light is. And the forms of the teacher come and go because they are involved in creation. But then when you pass this form into the actual current itself, it's all music. That true form is music. That's the Lord of the soul. We have to go into it. Now, in there, we don't have a single thing to do with this world. When I say that, don't go and get the wrong impression that you don't have responsibility to your family and so forth. I'm not referring to that. In the inner realm of the soul, where feeling is involved, you don't use mind to involve yourself with patterns of thinking. Because there is no condition like that in there. What is involved in there is bliss, joy. Now, if you have reached that level of surrender inside by your meditation, then you will be used by the Lord of the soul to help another soul in creation, not in the realm of the soul, but in creation. Now, let's say a soul is living in Africa and it's in creation, or living on Venus, whatever you want, in this creation, and it's ready to go out. By its long years of meditation, when the Lord of creation sends the angel of death to take that soul to account for its karma, and if that soul merits going to the Lord of the soul, and you are living in the creation, not having anything to do with the creation, but totally solvent, not bankrupt in this creation by karma, but solvent. That means there's not a single thing here you owe. Everything has been paid up. You're in the black. You have good access, good credit in the bank of the soul. Now you will be commissioned to act as a co-sponsor for that soul that squandered all its good virtues out in the creation. But let's say that soul has paid its debt by its own initiative and is now ready to go out. He has to have somebody to plead his case, somebody to act as a sponsor. You who have reached that level will be given that commission or that contract or that particular act to go intercede. So your own inner experiences will begin now to see yourself appearing or interceding for that individual. And that individual will dream of you, or he may actually see you in a materialized state, taking him out of the confines of creation into the Lord of the soul. That's why Jesus said, "You see me, you see the Father, and in me you have redemption." In that level of soul experience, being not attached to creation, you will be used as a channel to help others to come out of the creation. One person asked the great master, he says, "Master, all this sounds good and fine. How do I get there? How long does it take? And what is the price?" And the master said, "It doesn't take too long, and the price is love and fortitude, and don't panic." Because most of us pay the price of love, most of us pay the price of fortitude, but we don't pay the price of panic. He said, and that's the biggest price, because we all some way may panic out. As long as you don't panic in these internal experiences, you will come true.
What do you mean by panic?
The panic is that since you don't see some physical human being in the inner realm saying to you, you're doing the right things, therefore your meditations are perfect, and now you will not be abandoned by me. Continue as you are. Your mind, not your soul, your mind has suddenly removed the fear of separation. Therefore, your mind is looking for some tangible form to tell you that inside. And the master is trying to tell you that there is no such thing, that your mind will ever be satisfied by some light image or spiritual image telling you that. So as long as there is no such thing to tell you that, the sense of panic will be in the mind. The sense of insecurity will be in the mind. Now if you let go and trust this impersonal force without a form. God has no form, you see. But trust it. Merely trust it on the essence of love and allow it to work you and mold you. Not mold the mind now, mold the spiritual nature of the soul. You will not panic. And therefore you will shed the mind, you will jettison the mind. You will jettison the idea or the feelings of panic if you trust. Now, let's take a child. From the time it's born, is there any panic in a child's mind as to you nourishing it or feeding it? But in your mind, if it cries, what happens? You panic. You don't even know if the child wants food. But you think because you put the something in his mouth, he stops crying, he's hungry. You see, that's our logical conclusion. That's what you know, that pleasure of something in his mouth is what really he needed. He may not really need that. But what else could you do to stop him crying? And excitation of the glands of on the mouth is only enough partially. Really, in the mind of the child, there is no panic, and the child really didn't need no nursing. But in your mind, to satisfy the condition, you have given him something to stop him crying, to ease the sensation of panic in your mind, and therefore now the child is conditioned that every time he cries, you got to have something to quiet him. So what happens? He's programmed into quietness, pleasurable release, by the wrong things, which the parent feels panic from, not truly knowing within the mechanism if that's what the child needs. And the child has no way to tell the parent verbally, I don't need to be fed, I just want to cry. Allow me to yell, it's good to yell. And what do doctors tell us today now? The child sometimes should cry and release the pressure, because basically it needs that too. But our panic, our concern gets so worked up that we go pacify the child. This is what we're trying to point out now in the inner consciousness. There is a point of spiritual growth where you will confront yourself between a visible form of the creative intelligence and a non-visible form. It's that non-visible form, that non-tangible form, is where the test, the real test of the soul begins. The visible form is the guru. The visible form is something that we relate to on a human level. The non-visible form is the trust of the pure spirit to take care of its creation. So we have to come to grips with this experience sometime or the other. And as we accept it, then the sense of panic leaves us. All right. Have you ever seen the picture of the angel walking behind the two little kids walking the bridge with a hole in the bridge? Ever seen those paintings? Most of the homes I go in, I used to see that picture. Now, the child don't know that the hole is in the bridge. And the parent doesn't know where the child is. But in the parent's mind, they got all types of panic and fear for the child. And yet, the painting has a peculiar other being walking behind the child. As my wife once said, we tax our guardian angel to the taxing point. And sometimes if they check out on us, we're really in a bad shape. We have protection from the Lord of the soul. We don't realize it, that he cannot abandon us. But we are not supposed to know that. And then the Lord of creation puts you through your tests. And you know that you're never being abandoned. You've got a lot of inner workings going for you. The soul was never designed to be abandoned by the Lord of the soul in a physical creation. But the mind is the instrument that the Lord of creation uses to keep the soul trapped in the creation. That's his game. He has to have something to panic you or to make you afraid. Because basically the soul knows no fear. The soul is perfection. It has no other way to, but it has to use mind to create this illusion. And it's such a very subtle function within your own nature to differentiate between mind and soul. Now, the soul is tied to the mind at Tishratil, the third eye point here. This is where it's tied. By the breath. When the Lord made this whole thing up, he took the body, linked the soul, and tied a knot. The knot of breath. The incoming breath ties or acts like a magnetic field for the soul nature and for the body nature. Then they're tied in at the breath. And the mind function keeps it acting. Now, we don't know that. As we break through by mental research and investigation, finally we see these laws all coming. As we evolve, we recognize it. This is what we call evolution. What we're really doing, we're just confirming what the scripture is saying about how we're constructed. The masters are really telling us nothing wrong with investigation, nothing wrong with research and evolution. But it'll take you too long to get out of this situation. Because basically, you don't know how long you were here. If you ask yourself, how long were you involved in creation? How long have you left the home of the soul to come into the creation or the carnival of creation and get involved with it? We don't know.
And the Lord of creation is like the judge who gives the sentence, and the Lord of the soul is like the governor that gives the pardon?
Yes. That is exactly how it works. But the governor has no condemnation for the prisoner or the person or who. He doesn't condemn. As it is in heaven, so it is on earth, is the scripture's own declaration. The creation is identical as the mental processes inside of us. Creation is an extension of what is already set up inside of us. They are not different. Yeah. Exactly the same. One is the image of the other. I'll give you a story. There was a king who wanted his life story painted in his new castle. And a young artist got up and said, "Your Majesty, I will sculpture your whole life story on this wall of the castle." So the king was very happy. As soon as the young sculptor said that, an elderly man got up and said, "Your Majesty, whatever he does, I will do in exact detail on the opposite side of the wall, and I don't have to see it." The king was much more happy. He'll have two walls now. So he assigned soldiers to separate the two men from working so that no one will see. So the young man will come in and work in his section, and they couldn't see what he was working on. And the elderly man was working on his side. And the day of the unveiling came. So the young man said, "Out of respect for your age, I'll let you unveil first," to the elderly man. The elderly man says, "No, out of respect that the king commissioned you first, and I merely challenge you, I'll let you unveil first." All right. The young man unveiled his side of the wall. And in perfect detail, chiseled in the wall itself, was the whole life story of the king right up to his present moment. Now the king was really impressed. Who can duplicate that without even seeing it? That's got to be a fantastic mind. Anyway, he made one declaration before he allowed the other man to unveil. "If there be a flaw of any type that is not exact, like this side of the wall on your side, your life is forfeited." for your boost. The old man said, "Your Majesty, please unveil my side." And they pulled on, and lo and behold, everything was exactly in detail on the other side. But after a few minutes, the king noticed there was a difference. On one side, the young man actually chiseled the whole life story. On the other side, the man had polished the wall to look like a mirror. And it reflected what was on the other side of the wall on his. So nothing was missing. Everything was in detail there. There was no way to take the man's life. But he didn't do any chiseling. The other guy did all the work to chisel it. All he did was to polish the wall. So soul is like that. Soul that is tied to us is like a young man's print. All in detail. The creative principles are all locked up in it. Mind is like the old man's print. So when you say you're old as your mind and young as your spirit, these are the principles they're talking about. Your spirit is eternally young and youthful, carrying the full imprint of the creative principles. And the mind is old and imitates. It's a reflection. The mind is a reflector of the spirit. You see, the mind never renews itself. It's the spirit that renews itself. The mind only acts as a mirror. But the mind is used to build upon principles. But it's never complete until the spirit is put into it. So we have to realize that the Lord of the soul and the Lord of creation are different levels in which we live in. We are all drawn back to the Father, who is the Lord of the soul. But while we are drawn back, we are going to be examined by our uncle. You know him or heard of him or referred to him as Satan or the bad guy or the devil. He's not a bad guy. He's not a devil. He merely happens to be the Lord of creation. That is, he's permitted to act in creation. Now, in your scriptures, it tells you how he came to be. Jesus often referred to him as the Lord of creation in a strange way. He said, "I saw," that means the Christ intelligence on the fifth level, consciousness acting on energy, "saw Satan," which is the energy acting on energy, the fourth level, or Lord of creation, fall, that means come down, as a light. This universe and its four realms are all manifestations of light. It's a creation. Light is a creation. It's here. It holds everything in perspective as a creation. This phenomenon that we see here came down and made itself into these four levels. Matter is the lowest level, acting upon itself. Energy acting upon matter. Consciousness acting on the matter. And the energy acting on the energy. These four are held here. And this is Satan. This is the adversary. The word means adversary. This is the opposition. This is the opposite pole to reality. There is no negativeness, there is no badness in it. It's just the direction in which it is moving. So it can be called the centrifugal energy, the energy that goes out or falls away from its source. Falling away doesn't mean it's being abandoned or it's seeking to separate itself. It's required that it goes out to hold the opposition, to hold the poles. Now, the opposite of light is sound. That's the opposite pole to light. And the sound is the Holy Word. Ultrasonic frequencies are the opposite pole to light, which is photons. So it is sound that sees and perceives through feeling that light moves out and form a creation. And that's what we have here. We are then living in the creation. We are the result of a creation. Therefore, we have a body, a chemical body. Now, the law of creation, this force field, can destroy the body. It can possess the body. It can tear it up. It can do a lot of things to it. Just like the devils did to the child of truth in the fire and so forth, and the pigs and everything. The body is a vehicle that it can work with. But it cannot destroy the soul. It cannot destroy the integral essence of this mechanism. Now, the Lord of the soul has control of both by virtue of love. And we are in it by this virtue of love. So, when Christ is saying, I saw Satan fall like a light from heaven, he is saying that this universe of light, which is the four levels, is the realm of the Lord of creation. And this is not my kingdom. Sound does not belong to this realm. The Christ principle is sound. It doesn't belong to the kingdom of light. It is sound that triggers light all the time. Light cannot trigger sound. In the physics, you know of light triggering sound? It's sound that triggers light. And this is why the Christ is always above the Lord of creation. That is why the Lord of the soul is above the Lord of creation. The Lord of the soul is sound. And if you go to the scriptures again, you see this, the scientific principle. In the beginning, in the source field, was the sound, was the ultrasonic movements. And the sound was with God, meaning the sound existed in a state of total wholeness or goodness. And the sound was made flesh. The sound gave the command to make the various vibrations and rates of vibration to crystallize. And the same sound, ultrasonic now, resided in man. That was one of the life forms. There are 84 million life forms, and man is only one of the 84 million life forms. And out of that one life form, the sun resided in it. Now there are two types of flesh. The sun was made flesh, you see. There are only two types of flesh, animal flesh and human flesh. And out of the two, human was the one in which the sun resided, as a measuring stick. Now, the Lord of creation knows this. The Lord of creation is in cahoots with this. In other words, uncle and daddy are in cahoots to play a game on us. And we might as well enjoy it. But if you get the realization that they can't abandon you, daddy can't leave you up, don't worry. Your salvation is assured already. In the higher realms of the spirit, there's no karma, because there's no law of creation to account it. In the lower realms of the spirit, the law of creation, there is karma. Karma follows you right up to the fourth realm. Energy acting on energy. When you enter the fifth realm, which is the Christ realm, there is no karma. You see? So,
I just had this question. If Satan is not a bad guy, then why are these Satan cults doing so many evil and bad things?
It's like at the carnival, you'll always find the comic and the barkers and the different people trying to outdo the owner of the carnival. Each one is trying to make his particular sideshow greater. It's games they play with themselves. They are really games that are playing with themselves. You see, all these games tend to flow from the mind. They don't flow from the spirit. The real game of the spirit is entirely different. The mind can make all kinds of games. When you realize what is happening and what is going on, then you see through the whole illusion of it. And you see what is really wrong. You are seeing a group of sick people. Not sick in a physical sense, they will be in a physical sense eventually. They are sick, not only in a mental sense, but they are sick in the psychic sense. There are different degrees of illness. You have physical illness, you have mental illness, you have psychic illness, and you have spiritual illness. And it takes a long time to recognize them. Some illnesses pass as a form of health. Until you know there are sicknesses or illnesses, you will never recognize them as illnesses. You will think that person is healthy and normal, but they're not. You have to be aware of what it is to say they're healthy and normal.
What are they then?
What is healthy and normal? Are they very healthy? What's wrong? Is that a cool question? I just said everybody had no
idea. I is normal, but nevertheless, what is normal?
For science, they always take some platform or reference point to establish a norm. Now, the way an object functions and behaves, they have to measure it against the pros and the cons, the hyper and the hypo, the excess and the deficiency, and then they establish a norm of its behavior. This is the way we go about measuring something. This is a mental registration. It's not a spiritual registration. It's a mental and a physical registration of measuring things. It's not a spiritual registration. A spiritual registration is surrender, which is very, very difficult to do. And in the world of creation, it is out of place. It's not designed for the world of creation. Therefore, a man like Jesus says, this is not my realm. This is not where I come from. This is not where I belong. In a spiritual measurement, it doesn't fit. Now, there is never a single spiritual master that lived in the world that came from the Lord of the soul that died in his bed and never had a healthy body. They all died from the violence incurred by the karmic condition in the Lord of creation's realm, because that's how the realm is designed. That they must go out by one way or the other. Either they incur national suicide, which you call martyrdom, or crucifixion, or they incur some type of illness in the body. There's never a single one of them who has a complete physical body in this realm of creation, because it's not designed that they remain in this creation with a healthy body. But to know that they came in, commissioned by the Lord of the soul to help us, is when they die. Because the Lord of creation has no control over their body. You see? Be ye not afraid of him who will destroy the body, but he will destroy both body and soul. And how that master leaves the body and go out of creation, his physical body would be the measuring stick now that he was truly a master of the Lord of the soul. His body would have some way to indicate, even though he was in the body alive, and let's say he has diabetes or he has tuberculosis. These are typical human diseases in this realm of creation. Yet he has a full realization of God. And you say, well, if you know God so much, how come you can't heal yourself? If you are so God-realized, how come you can't get off the cross? This is not the measuring stick. The measuring stick is, okay, I'll give up the body and leave it up to the Lord of the soul to say if truly I represented him or I came here to represent the Lord of creation. The Lord of creation cannot divide himself. Satan cannot divide himself. That means this creative force field cannot do something that would detract from its normal behavior to break down. Its creation is designed to grow, break down, and recycle itself. And it's not going to change that. Now, when intercession comes in from another realm, then this is a significant indication of something done different. So the body has to be subject to that. So that particular person who comes in with a sick body, with full realization, is paying the price of the sick body to stay in the creation, to work with the people. When the time comes for him to leave, it's the Lord of the soul who is saved to tell those who are left behind that they don't mourn or worry, that your teacher was from the Lord of the soul. Here, get your body back. Like in the case of Guru Nanak. Guru Nanak lived among the Indians and the Hindus and the Muslims, and he tried to